You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Tony Curtis made his film debut in 1949 in Crisscross. He played a Roomba dancer, and he had no lines, but he danced with the film star Yvonne DiCarlo, and off-screen he had an affair with her. Thus began a long, distinguished career in which he appeared in classic films like Spartacus, The Defiant One, Sweet Smell of Success, and, of course, Some Like It Hot. It also began a habit of having affairs with his co-stars, and as far as I can tell, yes, Tony Curtis has included pretty much everything of both of those aspects of his life in a new memoir called American Prince. It's published by Harmony Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Tony Curtis back to the show today. Hi.
Leonard, pleasure.
Now, the last time you were here was to discuss your autobiography. What's different about this book?
This is more emotional than the other book I was involved in. I decided I would... scenes and sequences that happened in my life were much better than trying to work my way through an autobiography or another one like that. So I decided in this one I would find little bits of doing with people that I loved and hated, and I decided that's what I would like to do. You know, I would read other books, other memoirs and biographies, and I never felt in reading them that whoever was writing it was really being very candid about himself. They were always covering it with the sleeves. Maybe they weren't married to that girl then, but they still were behaving like they were. And so
And you knew some of these stories. You knew some of these stories because you were going to those parties.
Right. And I knew all of them. So, all those stories.
So was it difficult, to be totally honest, after having been forced to remain secretive about much of your private
life? Well, no, not really. Coming from me, it works. If someone else was telling my story, I'd go nuts. But this way, I was able to tell, and you know what it did too, Leonard? It made me tell the truth, because it's coming from me. You know, and so I tried to do that with everybody in the book. And it's funny, as I was getting through it and going from, let's say, one environment to another, I found that the anger I had, perhaps, with the experiences were not anger at all. That they weren't impositions. They were my attitude for myself. If a girl turned me down, she turned me down because of her, when in fact she turned herself off me because of me. Some gesture, something I said or didn't behave in. So it straightened me out a lot.
And so you were working out things, and you finally understood why you might not have gotten a part that you thought you should have gotten and things like
exactly,
that as well.
Exactly, exactly.
We'll get to some of the rather surprising, even shocking stories you tell a little later, but did you feel that now that you're 83 years old, there's no reason to be coy about the circumstances of your life?
I feel that way. You can be honest now, honest to the core. Sure, you can tell stories about yourself that maybe you didn't tell before, but now you tell them, and I'm open to them to speak in any way I wish. I think people appreciate it, and, you know, I get it back from them. So just sitting with you for these few minutes, Leonard, I have a sense of freedom and openness.
Well, you know, this is a psychotherapeutic session, Tony, and I'm going to charge you later.
I would think so.
I'm sorry that the couch is occupied. Despite your title, American Prince, you certainly didn't come from a royal background. Why'd you call yourself that?
I rather like it. I liked it because it's America, and I always wanted to be a prince.
Played a lot of princes.
Well, I did. The prince who was a thief. I never played a princess. No, I did. And Some Like It Hot. So you see, I've touched on all the royalty.
Was the Prince Who Was a Thief your breakthrough?
Yes, it was. You know, that picture cost $190,000 to make. Costume never went out and grossed $2.5 million, and no one ever heard of me. I was thrilled. I was thrilled. I couldn't understand why people like me to go to it. Well, my darling girlfriends. Everybody was my girlfriend. They were all the age to be a girlfriend. And they fell in love with me. My hair, the way I looked, my blue eyes. I loved it. And I didn't like it because of an ego. I liked it for what it was.
But you had been working in any number of films for Universal. You were under contract and not made the big breakthrough, even though you had the looks and all. Did they just not respect you as an actor?
Well, these pictures that I made for them were all B-movies, the ones in the front. And they went out and made money. Do you know, they made enough money to pay for the publishing and the, you know. But talking to you now, Leonard, I can't be sure what it was. But I know they skipped over me. I know they treated me like a Jewish boy that I was. I'm not saying it was anti-Semitic.
Well, the studios were pretty much controlled in those days, or many of the studio heads were Jewish, weren't they?
Yes, but my dear friend, our studio was populated, or if that's not the right word, worked by many, many people who were not Jewish. From the top, okay. But from then on down, there wasn't any non-Jewish people.
Well, let's go back to growing up as a Jewish kid in the Bronx. You had a pretty rough childhood. What was your family like?
It was hard. My mother, I've come to this conclusion now, was a schizophrenic. She would slap me around for no reason at all. All of a sudden, I would see in her face something bothering her somewhere. If I went to bed, she would slap me so bad. I just went to bed. You just rinse off the sheets, put them on the clothesline, and that's the end of it. You know, why we made such a big megilla about wetting the bed, or if I went down and bought some groceries, if I didn't get it right. Oh, she would go insane. And that was very hard for me. You know, it wasn't that I expected it, Leonard, but I wanted a lot of love and affection from these grown-ups.
And then your brother, Julius,
yes,
was killed in an accident when you were a kid. He was the closest family member to you.
He was. He was a lovely boy. We played a lot. He was 9, and I was just going to be 12 when he died. And
Go on. This was during the Depression. So you were living in extreme poverty to the point where your parents even left you and your other brother in an orphanage at one point because they were unable to feed you.
Yes.
Wow.
That was an unhappy time for us because we didn't come from an environment that was even smelled like it was opulent. We were poor then, and now to end up in an orphanage was a double barrel.
Well, they only lent you to the orphanage, right? As soon as they got some money, they took
you out. Yes, well, I remember I didn't know any of that. And I was so defeated and felt so abandoned when that happened. And then there they were one morning. And
you became a tough kid, but at the same time, you became an actor. What happened? Did you see acting as the only way out of this?
Going to the movies was a great help because it gave me a chance to forget what kind of an environment I was living in and to see Errol Flynn bite into an onion. I would go home and try it myself. I saw his physique, so I started doing push-ups. You know, these people on the screen were teaching me. They were my friends. Cary Grant, watch him woo a girl and walk in and open the seat for her, let her sit down in the car and put the car in gear and drive away. Leonard, that was too good.
So here you are in New York, the center of theater in the United States, and theater is a billion miles away. It's the movies because you're going to the local movie house, and that's what you want to do.
Well, but more than that, I couldn't get into theater. What kind of a part could I play in a theater? What kind of an education did I have for theater? I knew I just wanted to be in the movies. I wanted to be that 35-foot image on the screen. I know that where my life would be. In the Navy, I was a signalman, and we had these big arc lights that were 10 feet wide. And I used to send Morse code signals to the ship because I was on base. And I would clean that big mirror. The mirror was concave. And when I took the carbon out of it and cleaned it, there I was, 35 feet big and handsome. Oh, my eyes sparkling. I said to myself, I must get in the movies. I cannot deny people seeing me.
But then you studied theater on the GI Bill.
Yes, right. Well, that was an important step because you had to do it through the theater. No, I didn't get any screen tests. I got it for working in the theater, which was a good place to show some of your skills.
Were you already using the name Tony Curtis at that point?
No. I was still good old-fashioned Bernard Schwartz.
So Bernie Schwartz, how long were you Bernie Schwartz?
Oh, about a month or two, and then I became Phil Sargent. I like that name.
And sounds like a stand-up comic.
But I tell you, when I ended up with Tony Curtis' letter, I knew I was going to be in. Can you imagine?
So you got into the films because somebody saw you in a play?
Yes, they saw me in Golden Boy down in the Cherry Lane. That used to be down here somewhere, the Cherry Lane Theater.
Still is.
Oh, there is,
Yeah, we'll have to put a plaque up, say, Tony Curtis got started here.
And they saw me in the play over a weekend, and Tuesday afternoon I get a call, come down to Universal's office. I go down and they give me a plane ticket, leaving that weekend for good old Hollywood.
You tell a story about something that happened early in your career about some direction given to you by Michael Gordon in the film The Lady Gambles.
Yes.
Why did that advice stick with you over the years?
Sticks with me right now. I was playing a bellboy, and I had a letter to deliver to Barbara Stanwyck. And my line was, it looks like it's followed you halfway across the country. I had no idea what it meant, but that's what I thought. So before I went on, I was off stage and a red light would come on. I'd hear, come in, and I'd come in and say, looks like it's followed you halfway across the country. It looks like it's followed you halfway across the country. It looks like it's followed you halfway across the country. I tried every conceivable way to say that line. And there I am waiting for that red light to go on, and I look to my right, no more than 10 feet away, is Michael Gordon, the director, and walking toward me. I got nervous. I said, what did I do wrong? Maybe he's going to tell me something. And that's what he did. He said, all you want is a tip. Ain't that the case in everything we do? I don't want to simplify it, you know, but me being here with you, all I want is a tip. All you want is a tip. It's great.
Tony Curtis is my guest. He's written with Peter Goldenbach, American Prince, a memoir. It is published by Harmony Books. We will continue our conversation after this.
Haven't I seen you somewhere before?
Not very likely.
You staying at the hotel?
Not at all.
The face is familiar.
Possible you've seen it in the newspapers or magazines, Vanity Fair.
That must be it.
Would you mind moving just a little, please? You're blocking my view.
Your view of what?
They run up a red and white flag on the yacht when it's time for cocktail.
You own a yacht? Which one is it? The big one?
Certainly not. With all the unrest in the world, I don't think anybody should have a yacht that sleeps more than 12.
I quite agree. Tell me, who runs up that flag? Your wife?
No, my flags do it.
Who mixes the cocktails? Your wife?
No, my cocktails do it. Look, if you're interested in whether I am married or not...
Oh, I'm not interested at all.
Well, I'm not.
That's very interesting.
Tony Curtis, obviously looking for a tip from Marilyn Monroe.
Right.
He's written a memoir called American Prince, published by Harmony Books with the help of Peter Golombek. You met Marilyn early,
long
didn't you?
Long before, yes.
Was she already Marilyn at that time?
She had just changed to Marilyn. She was playing with the word Marilyn, but she never mentioned her name. What was her name?
Betty something, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. She never mentioned it to me. All I knew her for was Marilyn.
Would you say
Leonard,
that?
She was beautiful.
Would you say she was your first love?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. There was something so divine about her. That she wasn't a small girl, but all of her features and every part of her body fit perfectly, do you know? And she was delicate as she walked. Now, this kid had been in and out of homes, in and out of hospitals, wherever, because her parents couldn't take care of her. Imagine if she would have been adopted by some family that would have given an education. She would have been something else again. But she still was so beautiful and giving and kind. It touched me very much. And perhaps she felt that about me. You know, I was, as we became lovers, we were like teaching each other. Yeah, it's like teaching each other the first steps of what it would be like, you know, not just getting laid, but a relationship starting out with all of that stuff. So.
Norma Jean and Bernie.
Norma Jean and Bernie Schwartz. Mrs. Schwartz. Norma Jean Schwartz.
Well, I'm
sure
it would have made you happy. It would have made me happy anyway. Could we clear up that whole famous line that you're quoted as saying, kissing Marilyn was like kissing
yes.
Hitler?
Let me tell you, my dear friend. We were in the rushes watching that scene, cuts of it.
The scene that we just played.
Yes.
That fabulous scene in which, you know, you almost do sound like Cary Grant.
Yes, yes, really. And that was the scene we were watching. And when it was over, you know, I was really embarrassed. Not embarrassed. I was embarrassed because this was the first time, perhaps, that I showed my true self, my true sense of who I was in that kissing scene. I mean, I was all open up for it. So was Marilyn.
So now, you had been lovers earlier, but you hadn't been together for a long time at this point. Was it not uncomfortable?
It seemed to be as if it was when we first met. There were it was a remarkable experience for me, you know, in that scene, to have her grinding into me. And I wasn't quite sure what she meant by that. Why would she grind into me? Was that a joke on her part to see if she could crack me up? I wasn't sure, you know, and it wasn't until I was in the rushes watching these guys and watching the scene. But, hey Tony, what was it like kissing Marilyn? Excuse me, a Gornish from Gornish. Tell me about it. I said, it's like kissing Hitler. What are you expecting of that? And that was it.
But I wonder about that because we know of any number of romances that grow out of people working in films together. Is it because even though you're acting, sometimes it stops being acting in your head?
Yeah, but it stops being acting when you are touched physically and feel it. You may not feel it in your brain. A lot of actors don't allow themselves that privilege. They'll play a love scene. I love you, my darling. Let's go to Paris. No, I can't go. They'll play that beautifully. But that doesn't mean anything to them. They're thinking, well, where am I going to go for dinner? But.
Well, they're on the fifth or sixth take, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. But if you're touched emotionally, if that's what you remember, and that's what I remembered with Marilyn, from those early days to that day, there was a heat between us that was very difficult for me to not pay attention to.
The both of you seemed to really need a lot of approval.
We did.
Did that make it more difficult to maintain a relationship? Because if you're very needy and she's very needy,
right.
somebody else has to apply.
We could never have ended up together. If we did, it would have been a short trip, and thank you very much. But we both needed that kind of support, and we couldn't give it to each other. An ejaculation may have, but that would be the extent of it.
You were doing that Cary Grant imitation. When you were a kid, as you said, he was one of your heroes. So what happened when you met Cary Grant? Was that the same thing as meeting? What happens when a movie star meets a movie star, but you've been a fan first?
For years. I saw him in a movie called Destination Tokyo. I don't know if you remember. The Warner Brothers made it. And he played the sub-captain. I joined the Navy because he'd been in the Navy.
I thought you joined the Navy to get away from the Bronx.
Well, certainly that. Then I became... I made myself available to be in the submarines, again, because of my dear friend Cary. And over those years, I don't know what the word would be. I thought about those times when... And we used to run Gunga Din on board this ship, and they'd shut the sound off when Cary Grant spoke, and I could do it. Oh, dear, I forgot that. That was so good, so cool. Anyway, I loved doing Cary. I enjoyed it. He, just doing him, you see, this is the secret of acting. When I talk like Cary Grant, I get to feel like Cary Grant. You know, that Bronx kid is not here anymore, you know. And that's what happened to me.
But did he turn out to be somebody you liked?
The best. The best. Extraordinary man.
My guest is Tony Curtis, who's written with the help of Peter Gollenbach, American Prince, a memoir published by Harmony Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. There are some feathers that are going to be ruffled here, and you've also, been rather honest about some of the relationships you've had, in some cases to married or attached women. Was Yvonne DiCarlo married when you had your affair with her? Or Natalie
Wood? Had a man that she'd been going with for all time. I guess their relationship wasn't as solid as she wanted it. You know, in a one-night stand, it didn't bother her, and that's just what it was.
And you were a very good-looking young man.
Yes,
And women, didn't the studio provide you with a breakaway shirt when you went on?
Yes, jacket breakaway. And they would organize these girls pulling on my clothes in the lobby of a theater where the owner of the theater said, "Get them out of here. The girls were all peeing in my lobby." Yeah, it was too good. These girls would hide in my closet at the hotel, you know.
We thought that only started in 1965, but obviously like 1950.
I remember it even before that, living in the Bronx. I always noticed girls kind of liked my looks or whatever it was, and I embellished it by smiling a lot and acting like a lover of some sort. You know, Lennon, I enjoyed it every day of my life.
Well, the movies also gave you access. Natalie Wood. Grace Kelly, when she was not yet a star at this point.
No. And, excuse me, I didn't have enough time to improve that relationship.
You just kissed
her. But if I could have, go look out. She impressed me so much by her candidness. You know, underneath that exterior of her was a very hard-nosed little chick, you know?
Not the person we think of as the princess,
no,
but rather as somebody
no,
who was...
No, you saw the way she behaved. All the movies they made of her, even in the movies she played, she gave you the impression of her. That doesn't mean she was bad, because she wasn't, but...
I wasn't saying she was. I think it's tragic that she died.
Yes.
You're critical about some of the people you work with. Jerry Lewis, Shelley Winters, Henry Fonda, Joan Collins all get mentions for bad behavior. Now, Jerry Lewis was one of the most obnoxious people I've ever had on the show, so I'm not surprised. But lovable Henry Fonda?
A putz.
He would not understand that word, but most New Yorkers will.
You know, I have a feeling from the time he started working in the movies, He hated all of his co-stars. He wanted to do better than them. Do you know?
He was competitive with his co-stars?
Jimmy Stewart was his. They both started at the same time. And I had heard from people that worked with Jimmy Stewart said that Henry was really so mean to him. And he was jealous of Jimmy because Jimmy was getting those good pictures. And so that I put that together. And when I was doing the Boston Strangler, he was most unkind. I needed a certain kind of attention from him. I didn't want him to kiss my ass. I just wanted him to pay attention to certain behaviors that I did, because that behavior showed him and the audience that I was nuts. And it was important that be there.
Listening is part of acting, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it wasn't with him. So I didn't like him for that. I always felt that he was nervous.
You write about Mae West's behavior on set.
Yeah. Did you ever?
What was she like to work with? Was she like the legend?
She was the best. She was the best. I was going to do this movie with her. And the assistant director, the day we started, said, listen, come in at 9:30. I said, well, tell me what you're going to do with her. He said, well, she comes in at 9:30, has a little breakfast. Then she takes off her clothes and puts on a robe. Then they start the makeup. Then they do her hair. And before they put her clothes on, she has an enema. I said, oh, is that the schedule? He said, that's it. I said, well, why don't you call me when she goes in for her enema and I could be at the studio in time? I said, okay. So he'd do that for me. The phone would ring. The enema is going. I said, thank you. I drive the 20 minutes to where I worked. And this was May. She was a funny little lady.
Do you think that you didn't get as many good roles as you would have liked because of the way you looked?
I think so.
Because I remember asking another actor from that time about going up against Paul Newman and Marlon Brando.
Yeah.
And I said, how did you know? This was Robert Wagner. How did you get any decent parts? He said, well, if they were sick or if they were on another project, I wound up getting the part.
That's right.
Well, you were on the Defiant Ones. You were nominated for an Oscar.
That Oscar was a phony. Sidney Poitier and I, what were they going to do, cut it in half? I'd get the part that eats, probably. But this is not the sour cream or whatever the expression.
Sour grapes.
Yeah, this is not sour grapes.
Sour cream goes with Blintzes. Yeah, it's a whole other thing.
Yeah, right. I like to say this about myself. I'm a consummate actor. I know my profession as well as anybody.
I think you should have gotten a nomination, or you should have won for Sweet Smell of Success.
Yeah,
you were
Sweet
extraordinary
Smell.
In that.
But, you know, nobody liked that movie.
Really?
In town, they didn't like the movie.
And now, of course, it's considered one of the classics.
One of the best movies ever made.
Why didn't you do some other things, like go into directing or producing, like Clint Eastwood did,
Kirk
Douglas?
I was thinking of that. Dear Lennon, I tell you, I could make a movie that would goggle every boggle. And maybe one day I will. Maybe I'll take my background and that stuff in New York City. I've got an idea of a kid turns into a gangster living in that and he's torn. There are stories that sound like that, but this is different. I may do that yet, but I was so enamored of being a handsome movie star. I didn't want to do anything but that.
You were married 6 times. People will
five times.
Well, so the fact that or what I've read about your being married to what was her name, Andrea Savio? That's not true.
No, never married to Andrea Savio.
Janet Leigh is, of course, the one that everybody associates with you.
Yes, and my next wife was Christina Kaufman, and after Christina came. Penny Allen, and after Penny Allen became
I'm glad
Lisa
you can remember
Deutsch, that's 4 now,
yeah.
And Jilly was my 5th wife.
Your current wife. You're also a painter. You have some of your work in the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art.
Yes.
So is that what really keeps you going these days?
Maybe. But, you know, talking with you, it sounds funny, all of the stuff that went on. You can't take it serious, you know, getting an Oscar or ending up in the picture that made the most money. It's all a game.
Well, you must have some favorites. You must have a favorite.
Oh, I do.
A favorite director, a favorite performer.
Yes, Stanley Kubrick. We did Spartacus together. Brilliant man. Funny. He came out of New York, too. He and I would stand there on the side, and he'd say to me, just picture us. We're in the gutter in the East Bronx. I said, you got it.
Was it fun working with Kirk Douglas?
Yeah,
from
very
Albany.
Much. I loved him. I still do. He's tough, but he's pleasant at the same time. And he's funny about it. All of these guys, Gregory Peck, Cary Grant was my favorite, though.
Well, you worked with him in Operation Petticoat.
Well, yes.
The peak of your career. No, well, not really, but it was great working with him, I'm sure. Tony Curtis's memoir, American Prince, written with the help of Peter Golenbach, is published by Harmony Books. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, Leonard, thank you for allowing me this privilege.